My guest in this session is an old friend. Stanley Kurtz is well known to all serious conservatives and libertarians, and maybe even to some aggrieved liberals who run into him and say, no, 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 that's not true. But it turns out, I think, very often to be quite true. Stanley Kurtz these days is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, former fellow at the Hudson Institute, the author of a number of books most recently, and this appeared last year, Spreading the Wealth, How Obama is Robbing the Suburbs to Pay for the Cities. We're going to get right down to that. Stanley Kurtz, first a cordial hello.
Milt, it's so wonderful to be back on your show.
Perhaps we might take a moment to remember, as you have done occasionally in print, I find, the program we did in 2008. You feature that in a recent article about the Obama administration's continuing attempt to influence, if not to say manipulate, the press and the treatment they get there.
Well, Milt, that's a show I don't think I'll easily forget, the experience of having our show flooded with callers at the behest of the Obama campaign demanding that I not be allowed onto your show, onto the air, even though you had gone and invited the Obama campaign to send a representative to debate me.
It was only a few weeks before the election of 2008. The Obama National Headquarters was just down the street from Michigan Avenue, where is located WGN Radio, the station at which we did that program. And yes, we did invite them, but that just posted them that we were having you as a guest. And instead of sending somebody to debate you, they got on their email system and told thousands and thousands of people that they called you various kind of low names and used various epithets, slime dealer, et cetera, whatever the hell they said. But they wanted everyone to call and object to your being on the air, object to my having you there, tell the management to not allow this, and so on. And so after we did the first hour of a two-hour program and went to the phones, that's what we got. And we were both rather surprised.
I sure was, Milt. I remember, actually, after having been told about these thousands and thousands of calls demanding that I not be allowed to appear, I was waiting. I don't know if people realize that when you wait to go on your show, you're at first in the lobby of the Tribune building in Chicago, which has engraved on the inside a whole series of great sayings in honor of free speech and the First Amendment.
Yes, indeed. But interestingly, this brings me back again. What I want to talk with you now brings me back to the final weeks of the campaign and a scene someplace in Ohio where candidate Obama is talking to a man whom journalists identified as Joe the Plumber. And he says in the conversation with Joe the Plumber, "You don't object to our spreading the wealth around a little, do you?" And I forget just what Joe's response was, though he seemed to be not fully in support of, quote, spreading the wealth around. But the term spreading the wealth around is relevant to something that you've been following rather closely as you monitor the Obama administration and its works and ways, particularly what they are doing, as you see it, with regard to a campaign for regionalism. And you've got some major pieces on that in various journals. And, of course, that's what your last book was about. So let's get into regionalism. What do they mean? What are they doing?
Well, Milt, on this theme of Joe the Plumber and spreading the wealth, most Americans, I think, are familiar with the notion that, say, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, the Health Care Reform Act, is ultimately about redistributing wealth from the large bulk of Americans to those who don't now have health insurance. So that's a very clear way in which we've been speaking about and debating this idea of spreading the wealth, but which most people don't understand and which I myself had not understood despite my initial research into Obama's past, is that he spent a great deal of time and effort as a young community organizer and a junior politician in the state of Illinois on a project called regionalism, which was a scheme cooked up by a number of thoughtful academics in concert with some of the community organizers that President Obama worked with. And the basic idea of this scheme was to find ways to undercut the political and economic independence of America's suburbs. And the fundamental idea here is that regionalists blame the suburbs for the problems of the cities, essentially because when people move out to the suburbs, they take their tax money with them. And so rather than looking to the policies of some of the Democratic administrations that have been governing the cities and why that might have been driving some people out, rather than looking at the huge burden that pension funds negotiated in sweetheart deals between public employee unions and the politicians who run cities, rather than looking at the role that all of that might have had in the decline of cities, the focus instead is on suburbia. And the thought is, how can we grab a hold of some of that suburban tax money and funnel it back into the coffers of the cities? And what this movement initially wanted to do was literally to go out and have cities annex the suburbs. And in fact, in the 1900s, this was not unheard of. Chicago, where you live, grew in many ways at first through annexations, chiefly because it was hard to find a way to do infrastructure at that point. Couldn't extend infrastructure to suburbs without help from the city. But at a certain point, state legislatures drew the line and said, you know, we can't have this continual annexation of independent municipalities without a vote, without a consent of the governed.
Let me, as a sidebar, just erase one particular place. The suburb, in quotes, of Detroit called Hamtramck, which in fact is fully enclosed on three sides, at least, by Detroit. I don't know the history of it, but I've often wondered, did they resist an attempt to annex?
That's fascinating, Milt. It's quite possible. I mean, I don't know the details of this history of how exactly the halt was called to the policy of annexation. It's sufficiently murky that the academics who first sponsored this notion of regionalism in its modern incarnation believed that they might be able to succeed through a strategy of annexation. But as they gradually discovered that most states had put this out of bounds, they began to develop a series of strategies for undercutting this political independence of the suburbs and transferring some of that tax money. I can give you an example if you like.
Before you do, would you agree that it's a kind of a variant of the Robin Hood strategy of rob the rich and pay to the poor?
It absolutely is, Milt. And in this example I'm going to give you, a lot of the opponents of this policy we'll be talking about in a moment used to call it Robin Hood politics.
Yeah, well, please go forward.
Well, there's something called regional tax-based sharing. This is one of the dream policies of the regional equity movement, or the regionalist movement, as it's sometimes called for short. And regional tax-based sharing exists now in the United States in only one place, the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. And what happens under regional tax-based sharing is that the state legislature in question forces the suburbs around a given city to kick in a chunk of their tax receipts to a regional pot. And then that's redistributed according to a mathematical formula that effectively sends the money from the suburbs to the cities and a few of the less well-off inner ring suburbs. You see, the Constitution, Milt, and a lot of people don't realize this, but the Constitution reserves all powers not granted to the federal government to the states. It doesn't actually say anything explicit about the powers of local governments. So even though by tradition we all hold the powers of local governments in a great deal of respect, and this in fact classically is part of what characterizes American democracy, and Alexis de Tocqueville, the great political theorist of American democracy, focused on the New England town meeting and local control when he wrote about the United States 150 years ago. But even though this is a hallowed tradition in this country, the fact of the matter is that technically a state government has the power to do almost anything it wants to a local government. And so the regionalists hit upon the idea of having the state legislatures compel suburbs to funnel a certain portion of their tax monies to cities. And this becomes a kind of de facto annexation. The municipal boundary may still exist, but in important ways, the significance of that boundary is undermined if you can get the state government to invade the sovereignty, so to speak, of the local municipality.
Well, what does the Obama government, as presently functioning, have to do with pushing this program along?
Well, regional tax-based sharing, and there are several policies in question here, but we'll stick with regional tax-based sharing for the moment. Regional tax-based sharing was long a favored policy of the community organizers who mentored Barack Obama. And one of the things I talk about in my book is that many of these organizers are actually still working with the Obama administration, advising them on a range of policies. And one of the things I talk about in Spreading the Wealth is a conference that was conducted literally in the White House on the invitation of the Obama administration, where his old community organizing buddies were able to arrange what was effectively a lobbying session where local politicians from states that with some prospect of passing this regional tax-based sharing were invited to the White House, got to meet with cabinet secretaries and high advisors to the president, and generally have been collaborating with them with the idea that they should go back to their states and adopt regionalist policies, including the idea of regional tax-based sharing in the legislatures. But in addition to lobbying informally for state-level politicians to pass these policies, what I've been writing about recently are the various ways in which the Obama administration, particularly through the Department of Housing and Urban Development, but also through the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Transportation, are beginning to dribble out a series of policies which potentially could be quite transformative in, again, undercutting the political and economic independence of the suburbs and ultimately redistributing the wealth from the suburbs to the cities.
Well, what else are they doing along those lines?
Well, for example, the Department of Housing and Urban Development just issued a very, very ambitious new rule. And most of the lobbyists on the left who have been pushing the administration to do this have been frank in stating that the administration withheld this rule until after the election because of the level of controversy it was likely to generate. And what this rule does is to compel any local municipality that receives federal housing aid, and that includes probably the majority of municipalities in the country, they have to create now a map, a kind of fairness map, so-called, which charts where people live in that municipality by race, by ethnicity, by income, and charts the proximity of each group to public transportation, to business districts where a lot of jobs are available. And the upshot of this is that once you do this mapping and begin to define it, as the new Obama rule does, as the only way to be in compliance with a law called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. This is a law that any municipality has to, this is a principle any municipality that accepts federal funding for housing has to agree to affirmatively further fair housing. Once you define that according to the new rule, a great deal of pressure is immediately put on almost every municipality in the country to build dense development, to build dense housing, and to zone for heavy businesses near public transportation, near subway.
So look, if you're the mayor of Scarsdale, New York, you are. Who is communicating with you about what you've got to do to kind of turn Scarsdale into a variant of Bedford-Stuyvesant?
Well, if Scarsdale receives a grant from the Obama administration, for example, something called a community development block grant, and that's a kind of grant that often comes out, they've got to sign an agreement. And the agreement says that they are required to affirmatively further fair housing. Now, up to now, that's been...
And that by fair housing, that means not only apartment house-like piles of housing or also compact townhouses in some new development, but rather low in production cost and low then in rental. But they've also got to invite in some people from the equivalent of Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Yes, and this is, of course, a radical transformation of how that rule has traditionally been interpreted. Traditionally, the rule has been interpreted to mean you have to take steps to make sure that people are not overtly discriminating against someone because of religion, race, ethnicity, etc. But the new rule so broadens the notion of fair housing that it's no longer about preventing discrimination. There might not be any classic discrimination in the sense that that is usually meant or defined. So this broadening and radical redefinition of the rule in effect becomes a license for a kind of social engineering, and we've...
Okay, but how do you respond from a likely complaint or a likely criticism you might get from somebody on the left, somebody writing, for that matter, an op-ed for some leftist magazine like, say, The Nation or what have you, and arguing that unless you're going to urge people of lower income, and particularly blacks in Bedford, Stuyvesant, and places like that, to move to Scarsdale and housing you are providing at costs similar to what they pay in their original location, unless you do that and yield to all of that, you are racist. You are essentially preserving white privilege against a fully integrated society.
Well, that's a great question, Milton. I think the basic idea...
That's a common likely criticism, is it not?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I think... it goes to the heart of the philosophy behind the regionalist movement. I think that regionalists, and I talk about this in the book, the regionalists have the notion that the cause of problems for impoverished and minority areas in American cities is what they call concentrated poverty. And their thought is that if you could only break this up geographically and parcel people out into different areas, very much including the suburbs, then the people involved would be more likely to absorb middle-class values. Ironically, even though many of these people reject what are called culture of poverty arguments, implicit in this theory is a kind of culture of poverty notion. But I think that's a misunderstanding of how the classic American dream running through the suburbs really has always worked. What really makes you middle class is not being plopped down in an area where other people are already middle class. It's the discipline that you have to undergo to work, to save up money, until you can afford to buy a house wherever it is that you want to move. It's that whole experience that really turns people into members of the middle class rather than just plopping someone
right
down.
Let me try something that may be a little bit surprising, or at least is coming from left field. One of the close advisors to President Obama, he brought him to the White House or to Washington as a czar, was former colleague of ours at the University of Chicago, Cass Sunstein of the law school. Sunstein was the author of a book titled Nudge, N-U-D-G-E, which he argues some of the major social changes that you want to effect can best be achieved by pushing people, not by in one or another direction, by nudging them in one or another direction, not fully telling them what the ultimate outcome of the behavior you're eliciting will be, but all the same serving some social changes that you've got in mind. Is the nudge philosophy, push people into this kind of new housing operations within their neighborhoods, is it intended ultimately to produce the effects that we're talking about? And are those effects veiled in terms of examination of the present purposes of the policy?
Well, I think the notion that something is veiled here, you've hit the nail on the head with that, because the interesting thing about President Obama's regionalist policies is that he doesn't really like to talk about them much. President Obama did make one speech on the regionalism theme very early in his term. It was only one speech, and the press paid very little attention to it. There was one other speech he made when he was running in 2008. But other than that, he doesn't really talk about regionalism, even though it's not controversial among those who follow departments like housing and urban development and other departments that there are many regionalist administrators in the Obama administration, and regionalism is definitely something they're pushing. And yet you won't hear President Obama speak about this in a State of the Union address. He won't open up a news conference talking about it because he understands that it would be politically controversial. Instead, they have indeed tried to nudge people in this direction unobtrusively, almost under the radar, you could say, in a variety of rules that don't get a lot of publicity. And that's one of the reasons I wrote Spreading the Wealth, was to try to get it out there that No, the Obama administration, this is a major theme. This is, and you know, there was a time, Milt, when urban policy during the Johnson and the Nixon administration, running up through the Carter administration, almost every president had to have an urban policy or an urban-suburban policy. And this was a focus of public debate. These were major themes. Well, we're not talking about them anymore, but the fact of the matter is there are some very proactive policies going along these lines. And
well, Lyndon Johnson was engaged in two great wars, the war in Vietnam and the war on poverty. The war on poverty clearly was in that second classification.
And I think that the sense that people have that the war on poverty was a failure is what really took urban policy out of the limelight.
Let me ask you, if only briefly, because something else I do want to get to, based upon some new fascinating writing that you've been doing. But first, just quite briefly, students in various universities are pressing hard upon their administrations a divestment of fossil fuel investments, divestment of the investment. That is to say, a way of controlling and limiting use of coal and oil and even gas, I suppose. Does that in any way, now that's not an Obama administration initiative, but I gather they are backing it all the same. Does that belong in the same category?
Well, there's, I do think there's a spreading the wealth aspect to this fossil fuel divestment theme. In addition to that, the reason I really hit upon this fossil fuel divestment crusade, particularly in the universities, is because I think it says something about where the culture is right now and where our politics has ended up. Because as I see it, and I think many others as well, the millennial generation, these young people who range in age from college age to about 30, really are behind the political shift in the country, pushing us a little more to the left. They really are, these young people are a crucial element of Obama's coalition. And to a degree that I think people who are not in that generation find difficult to understand, young people are right now deeply focused on and inspired by the idea of fighting to stop global warming. Even though I think that is a rather problematic crusade, it has kicked off tremendous enthusiasm among young people, particularly in our colleges and universities. And I think if conservatives, like myself, want to make some headway against changes in the culture that we view as unfortunate, we have to take this movement seriously, even though it seems to many people who are not so young as a bit of a quixotic crusade.
Now, I want to turn to something else, which is quite fascinating. Ordinarily, we talk about the writing of books and of articles by our guests, and you write lots of books and lots of fine articles. We've just been talking about an issue which is covered in your last book and in a number of still more recent articles. But also, sometimes our friends write very important book reviews, and I hold in my hand your book review, which is really, of course, an extended essay in the Claremont Review of Books, I believe, in the current edition. Your review of two books, one, The Islamic Paradox, Shiite Clerics, Sunni Fundamentalists, and the Coming of Arab Democracy by Roel Marc Gerecht, and The Wave, Man, God, and the Ballot Box in the Middle East by, again, Roel Marc Gerecht, both, I believe, published by Hoover. No, one is by AEI Press and the other by Hoover Institution Press. So here we have a whole view of what the turmoil in the Middle East and the murders in the Middle East. We've had just this very day, which I believe is August 12th, some 70 or 80 people shot down on the streets of Cairo. What is the general view that you are developing here?
Well, Milt, what I say in that review, and I'm writing that review really because the Claremont Review of Books felt that in light of everything happening in Egypt now, it's time to reconsider America's democracy promotion policy at its roots.
Uh-huh.
And Roel Marc Gerecht is really the most intelligent, the most thoughtful, and arguably even one of the most influential proponents of democracy promotion. I tend to be more skeptical of democracy promotion, and so the Claremont Review of Books, I think, wanted someone to have a look at that in light of what's going on in Egypt. And as an anthropologist by training, I tend to look at
PhD, Harvard University.
Yes, I
in anthropology.
Absolutely, social anthropology, and I tend to look at the Middle East through that lens, as well as others. And most of the writing I have found since all of the trouble in Egypt and since the Arab Spring began to collapse has glided smoothly right over what I think is the crucial issue, which is the way the traditional social system in the Middle East and in Egypt, which is built around a very sophisticated form of tribalism, a complex kinship system, in addition to religion, which is what we usually speak about. It's this underlying social system and is the tension between it and modernity, between traditional Muslim social practices and the idea of a neutral bureaucracy or free enterprise. All of these things, I think, are at the root of the Middle East conflict. And we're speaking in our back and forth in public debate as though it all has to do with politics, horse race, who's supporting to who, who's backing who. And we're not looking at the big picture. And I think when you do, it tends to make you even more skepticism of democracy promotion as a policy than you already are.
Well, now, in that context, what does, according to correct interpretation and or yours, what does the Muslim Brotherhood represent? What is their role?
Well, the interesting thing about Gerecht, and I think his position is actually consistent with that of not only many conservatives, but even with that of the Obama administration, although the Obama position is ever shifting. But for those who have been relatively tolerant of the Muslim Brotherhood and its position in Egypt up until recently, the idea, I think, expressed better by Gerecht than anyone else, is that as tempestuous and difficult as it might be, it is probably necessary in this view to give control of Egypt to the Muslim Brotherhood simply because that's what the popular view would be. And if you put someone like the Muslim Brotherhood in for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you'll find over time that society will become disenchanted. It's hard to be a religious crusader when you can't make the trains run on time. And the hope of the democracy promoters is that when you allow people to vote in these seemingly illiberal and anti-democratic groups and let them take power, eventually, after a period of tumult and difficulty, it turns out in favor of democracy. And
well, this is in that mode or that style of social thought, which is based on the proposition we have to let things get worse before they can begin to get better.
Exactly. And so I make a couple of points. The two basic points I make in my review are that when you really look at the underlying social factors that are blocking modernization in the Middle East, you see that this strategy of allowing the Islamists into electoral power is really not going to work. And then my second point is that even if you bracket that question, Iran, which Gerecht actually sees as a positive model, some may find that hard to believe, but Gerecht's sense is that although the Iranian regime is a very bad one, and although they remain in power, the populace as a whole has become disenchanted with them. There was a failed, but nonetheless energetic, green revolution a few years ago. So Gerecht sees Iran as an example of how, over time, the population becomes less Islamist, more democratic, more
yes,
friendly to the United States.
But there is a real cost in this. For example, there may be millions who support the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt at the moment. There are millions equal in size, maybe even greater in size, who are liberalizing and who resent the heavy hand of orthodoxy and the way in which it controls societal values and societal traditions, including, for example, the treatment of women and the veiled presence of women on the streets of Cairo and Alexandria, who want an end to all of that. And, for example, this would also be offensive to somebody who was our guest on this podcast series only a few weeks ago, and his commentary is up and available for any who want to find it and read it. This is Samuel Tadros, who is an Egyptian Copt, a scholar, a young man, who is with one of the institutions in Washington focused on the study of modern religion. And Tadros argues that his people, the Copts, are being hindered and assaulted and even killed right now with the new fundamentalist enthusiasm that raged for a while, and that their future is endangered by continued dominance by the Muslim Brotherhood. So you're asking some people to pay kind of a heavy price for the next 20 or 30 years before everyone becomes disenchanted with Salafism or some other variant of Muslim orthodoxy.
Well, that's exactly right, Milt. By the way, I like Tadros's work a great deal, and I respect him. He's a very smart and thoughtful fellow, and I take your point, and I discuss it at some length in the review, the notion being that in Gurek's work, you can have an almost pure experiment, so to speak, where somehow the Islamists take over and gradually folks become disenchanted, but precisely because society in the Middle East is split so deeply in its fundamental assumptions between the secular class and the traditionally religious class, it's tough to get the kind of basic consensus on a few underlying issues that's necessary for ordinary democracy to progress. And because that is the case, the idea that we can somehow run an experiment for 10 or 20 or 30 years without seeing the kind of explosion that we've already seen doesn't make a lot of sense. And again, I think the reason we see that polarization between the groups to begin with is because something about the way traditional Islamic society is structured tends to force a radical cultural choice. It's hard to find a synthesis. That's why, for example, in Turkey, you had Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey, was himself a secularist. And, of course, Turkey now is slipping more into the hands of the Islamists. But what I find interesting is the way in which the choice set up in Turkey is a fairly radical one. You either have to take this very strong Kemalist secularist position, or you're an Islamist. And what we've seen in many other cultures where synthetic ways of harmonizing tradition and modernity develop, this doesn't happen so much in the Middle East. And I think that comes back to certain fundamental features of the social structure and religion. I don't think it's impossible to overcome these, but I think that the barriers are, relatively speaking, more powerful in the Middle East than elsewhere. And if we don't take them into account, it makes us overly optimistic about the prospects of democracy promotion.
Way back at the beginning of the Ataturk regime, which was a secularizing regime, the costs were rather heavy for those who remained traditional Islamists. Some of it sounds merely silly, as, for example, requiring men who wear fezes, those little red caps, red conical caps that were a mark of one's true Muslim identity, at least in Turkey, the requirement that they no longer be allowed to wear red fezes and were fined if they were found wearing them. But beyond that, there was really a transformation of the life of the Turkish family, or at least of the Islamic Turkish family, in that they were not allowed to maintain essentially purda and the rejection and the blindsiding of Islamic women, so that they were not essentially allowed out of the house or allowed to show any more of their corporeal presence in their eyes. That was the way Turkey was. Turkey is no longer that way. One can't imagine that any Islamist regime, even if in full power in Turkey, can go back to a full restoration of Turkish society circa 1905. And similarly, one sees tremendous religious division, not merely between secularists and religious, but of course between the two major divisions of Islam, so that in Iraq to these days, just about every weekend, you have the bombing of Sufi mosques, rather the bombing of Shia mosques by Sufis, because they resent the Shia being in power in the government, and because they want fuller claim on, I suppose, the values of citizenship, but also they want fuller claim on the oil riches of the country. Islam clearly is not a single force against a single counterforce of secularism. It's a rich and more complex time. I think you have to read Bernard Lewis to really get a sense of it all.
Well, I agree, Milton. I think one of the questions that comes to mind when we look at what's happening in the Middle East is, what actually is happening here if what is happening is not an Arab Spring? If it's not a flowering uh-huh. of democracy, what is it? And I really argue in this new piece that it's a kind of social collapse, which goes back to Bernard Lewis's famous book titled What Went Wrong? And although I tend to tie it a little bit more to these anthropological issues of social structure than Lewis, but I think it's completely compatible with what Lewis argued. I think that the difficulty of finding a way to harmonize the traditional social system and modernity is undercutting the economy and also the military strength and the power of the state to such a degree in the Middle East as a whole that society is unraveling there. And in traditional Middle Eastern society, either you have a very tough, suppressive autocrat at the top who keeps the peace, or you get all of these, what used to be called by the British, fissiparous tendencies.
Yes, wonderful.
You know, we have some splits along all of these lines, secular and modern, Shia and Sunni, as you referred to. And I think that's what's happening, and I'm afraid that that we could be in for much more of this, that we may be moving to a situation of relative anarchy, of weak states, that it just becomes chronic.
Stanley, a last question, and back to Stanley Kurtz. What's just been illustrated in our brief conversation is the broad range of your interests, from regionalism and the Obama administration to the Middle East and its Arab Spring, which is not really an Arab Spring, but maybe a reversion to fundamentalism and an opposed reversion. That's a broad range of interests, and I know you've got many others. How do you account for your own Catholicity, for your own rich focus on 10 or 12 different realms of concern at one time?
Well, Milt, I always felt as though I used to say to myself as a kind of a joke that I actually had two PhDs because first I got my PhD in anthropology, which was actually fairly interdisciplinary. But then I ended up teaching in a great books program, in a program that focused mm-hmm. on the social sciences and political philosophy. And the students from that undergraduate program tended to go into careers in public policy. And rather than focus on my own publications during that period, because I'd already put out some publications, I decided to throw myself into teaching and to really master these great books. And I used to tell myself that it was like giving myself a second PhD. So somehow the combination of my anthropological training with this shift to the broad-ranging Great Books program, really all of that makes possible what I do now.
And one should specify that was the Great Books program, I gather, in Soc 2 at the University of Chicago.
Oh, actually, it was a similar but somewhat competing one, this program in social studies at Harvard University.
Oh, well, I see.
At Chicago, I was in another place called the Committee on Human Development.
And yes, so you were, yeah. And we were never much in touch in those days, even though I was on the campus as well.
No, we weren't. We weren't. I really didn't have any. I at that time, I really was focused on my scholarship, and I really didn't have any kind of profile in public work until I left academia. And even though I had connections with the Department of Psychology, which I think is where you were,
yes, quite.
I never actually ran into you. I'm sure we must have passed each other. Walking along the path there.
Well, we've been reunited certainly by virtue of prior adventures shared on the radio and by virtue of this excellent conversation. I thank you so much, Stanley, for joining. I hope to do it again soon.
Thanks so much for having me, Milt. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for coming.